Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, August 11, 2016. Tonight's science topic, I'm going to be talking about Earth, the many layers of Earth, something you're not going to hear about in a textbook or any place else, but it's very obvious. It's real data. It's not something you make up or whatever. First, I just want to remind you that there's a red letter sale on the sales page. That's all I'm going to say. Go to the homepage, jmccsci.com, and that's the extent of commercials for this show, if you call that a commercial. Anyway, but besides, there's a lot of information on the webpage. Remember, all of the shows are archived there for free. Going back about 15 years, there's people that have listened to many, some have listened to all of these. They go back in time. So the webpage, very filled with information. If you remember, last week I talked about salts, a very interesting topic. If you missed that show, make sure you go back and listen to the archive. But salts are simply elements. Some of them combine, some of them remain by themselves in terms of chemical composition. But, for example, Himalayan salt, which I talked about, 84 different elements in that. And that's why it's good for you, because all of these, what they call trace elements, are necessary for your health. But the question is, where do they come from? And when we look at salt and the composition of your body, for example, the blood or the fluids in your body, they match the chemical composition of salt, and that salt was deposited while there was an ocean there at a time in history. So basically, let's imagine you, your species evolved on a different planet. You would have a different chemical composition from us as humans, even though DNA is the same. But how it adapts to the available resources is different. And so, of course, there again, you're not going to hear about that on the evening news. The thing I want to talk about tonight is the layering of Earth. When the BP oil spill occurred, something I'd been talking about prior to that was the fact that they're drilling, you know, 18 miles down into the ground to get these oil deposits, and they couldn't figure out where they were coming from. So along comes this concept of abiotic oil, and it was developed in both the East and the West, the Russians and the U.S. Some people were trying to figure out where oil came from. And so to correspond with the accepted theory that Earth formed all at one time, and there it is, Earth, you know, as you know, that the oil was somehow created down in those deep caverns after Earth formed, and thus this idea of abiotic oil. And also water. They're saying that water formed, and there's one little teeny diamond that they have a speck of chemical attached to it that contains hydrogen and oxygen, and they're going, oh, that's the source. There's oceans of water deep in the Earth crust, and it's a secondary interpretation of data. It's not true at all, but there's people who have jumped all over that, imagining that somehow there's water very far down in the Earth's crust without any real experimentation to prove that there is. Apparently, Gaddafi was using deep well water to supply water, and they had literally rivers of water flowing through Libya, making it green. They had a beautiful country until the Clintons went in and destroyed it, absolutely destroyed that country, its entire infrastructure. The people in Libya all received a salary because of the oil money. It was education was common. They had better education than in the United States. But, of course, they're labeled as a third world country and terrorist. But they had a beautiful country with food for everybody. And that food came from water that came from deep wells. But the point is, now I want to lead into this by talking about something that a little project that I have going on, and some actual what you call pay dirt, literally digging holes. Now, I've studied archaeology, I've studied the Nazca lines, I came up with the solution for what those lines really mean, what their physical, I have the paper on my webpage, you can go get the solution to that. But those are archaeological issues, but whenever you're studying archaeology, these objects many times are covered with layers and layers of dirt, and when they dig up an archaeological site, they typically take that dirt, take it away, dump it in a pile somewhere, and don't examine the dirt at all. Like, well, where did all this dirt come from? And the actual reality is this dirt is falling in from outer space all the time. It's blowing around the world also and covering up objects, but there's a certain amount of material that comes into Earth every day, including water, minerals, salt, and that's how the oceans became salty. I talked about this lunar tail, the fact that our moon has a tail of sodium. And sodium is a rather easy element to detect, so I suspect there's other materials in the lunar tail. It's a comet tail, and it extends as much as 400,000 kilometers out in space. Earth passes through this tail every time we have a new moon. That is when the moon is between us and the sun. And so Earth also is picking up sodium. Sodium happens to be one of the primary elements in the composition of the Earth in terms of salt. So sodium chloride sulfates provide the majority of material that in terms of salts in the Earth's crust. Now, if you look, which I'm doing right now, if you look at the composition of the Earth in general, in terms of numbers of atoms. Now, remember that hydrogen is going to be first on the list. Hydrogen is the most commonly found element not only in Earth but in the universe. So it's not a surprise to find that hydrogen is one of the primary elements in the Earth. But in terms of mass, it's not that much. You find an awful lot of iron. Our Earth is very rich in iron, which is good for the steel industry because we have vast steel deposits, and they've certainly learned how to make use of steel and other metals. But the point is, the concept that the Earth was created all at one time or that the moon was created all at one time is simply a fabrication. And so before shows and during my studying during the week, I flip around and look at, just do internet searches to see what kids would learn if they wanted to ask the question, what was the Earth made of? How did the Earth form? How did the moon form? What are comets? And let me just pull this up. I just typed in the word comets. And here's the first thing that comes up. It's a space.com article, and it says comets, facts about dirty snowballs of space. Now, the European Space Agency has landed on the surface of a comet. We have visited, a half a dozen comets now with space probes. Not a single one of them is this dirty snowball thing. The lead scientist from the European Space Agency on camera at the Paris Air Show last year said on camera, he said, comets are not dirty snowballs. He said, what we've thought all along is totally incorrect. Yet, here is what you get. This is the the internet, controlled internet, especially regarding science. That, here's space.com, which you would imagine would be an authority. And then you've got the second one that comes up is Astronomy for Kids. And let me just click on this and see how far I have to read before it claims that comets are dirty snowballs. So anyway, here is what it says. This is for kids. It says, what are comets? A comet, it says, now, I will read this stating that this is what it says here. This is not me talking. This is the article. It says, a comet is a small world which scientists sometimes call a planetesimal. They are made out of dust and ice, kind of like a dirty snowball. I cannot stand it. Anyway, the point is that comets are not dirty snowballs. Never have been, never will be. But how can they continue to keep pushing this idea? And this is my something I constantly remind people of, that science is the dumbed down, most dumbed down, obtuse lie in everything. This is just the tip of the iceberg, not to use a pun there. Science, as taught to the public today, which is, you know, begins with kids, is totally 100% incorrect, has nothing to do with any form of reality. Comets are the discharge of a solar capacitor or a fusion star. This is happening in other star systems all over the universe, and they are layering up, that process of dragging in material. And I'm not going to go through the whole theoretical structure of the of my plasma discharge comet model, but the Earth is doing the same thing. So when we have severe weather, and a lot of times water comes in from outer space, because that water was not coming from the atmosphere. We can see a dry atmosphere all around the storm system. There was no water that, say, came in from the Gulf of Mexico or the Pacific Ocean, the typical sources of water. And all of a sudden, all this water is being dumped in a certain area. So the idea is that this water literally comes from outer space. And my theoretical work explains why this happens. Not only does it explain that, but a guy named Lou Frank, with the Ultraviolet Explorer, ultraviolet cameras on spacecraft, showed that these are visible on a constant, ongoing basis. The upper atmosphere glows with water, basically the signature, the spectroscopic signature of water. And so this material is constantly coming into Earth. And you might say, well, gee, why doesn't the ocean level rise because of this? And the answer is that most of that water ends up at the poles. There's a hydrological cycle that moves this water up to the polar region, the north and the south polar region, and those ice caps are accumulating and growing very rapidly. The layering of Earth is a constant. It's a constant process. And now, with that in mind, I want to bring up this digging process that I have undertaken. What I'm doing is digging holes, you know, just a couple meters by a couple meters. In these areas, you can find people that, you know, they're very good. That's what they do. That's how they get water, for example. That's how they dig wells. So it's a common practice. You might think, well, gee, that's a very difficult work, and it is, but there are people that's what they do. And so, anyway, it's very interesting what you find as you go down into the ground. And this is one of the most interesting recent finds, is a tree about 40 feet down. It's a tree that's laying on its side, and the wood is beginning to petrify. So that means that tree has been there. Now, the tree is not rotten. The wood is moist, which means literally that there has not been any oxygen. There has not been any oxygen at that tree, even though the water is there. And we're doing more examination to see the salt content of the water, etc. So it's a ongoing process. But the point is, here we find this tree laying down on its side 40 feet down in the ground. And it's laying on beach sand, which means it probably washed up from an ocean. Now, sand is something that only comes from ocean processes. It doesn't, there's no other formative process that forms beach sand. And that's why when they did ocean drillings down in the central of the Atlantic Ocean along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, they came up with beach sand. And the scientists, really, they don't like to talk about that because beach sand forms at the beach. So where was the beach that was at the, you know, in the middle of the deepest part of the Atlantic Ocean? And so now the other point about the hole that was dug, one of many, but this one had a very interesting find, the piece of wood that's becoming petrified. And by the way, the petrification process takes hundreds of thousands of years to occur. So here you have a tree laying on beach sand high up in the mountains. And, you know, so that indicates that that area was a beach at one time, literally an ocean beach. And this is probably, you know, at least 100,000 years old. The other point is that this tree became covered very rapidly. The tree became covered because if it would have laid there on the beach for 6 months even, it would have had mold, it would have had fungus, it would have rotted, it would have become, the wood is still solid. You could build a chair out of the wood. So that tree became covered very, very quickly. Do you see what you can tell? And like I said earlier, at archaeological sites, they take the dirt and they throw it away. Well, to me, the dirt is one of the most important things that you should analyze at an archaeological site, because that tells you what happened. Why did this site become covered with, you know, 200 feet of dirt? Just a little aside note, when I was younger, in my 20s, I went to Mexico. When I graduated from college, I decided to postpone my graduate studies, which I had 3 offers to study in graduate school, physics. And I said, you know, I'm not ready to just go straight into school. I don't want to be like all the other people that just go straight to grad school. I said, I want to go out and just follow my nose around the world. So I went to Mexico. I taught in a high school there and traveled. And in my travel, because of a friend who knew a friend, etc., I went out to an archaeological dig and spent time there and was at this archaeological dig, and they were uncovering a pyramid. Now, this was one of the major, major pyramids, I understand now. I have not been back there since to that particular site. It's down by Cuernavaca off of Mexico City, and it's a major tourist attraction now. But when I was there, they had just uncovered the very top of the major pyramid of that site. And the reason they found it is because a farmer was trying to grow corn on the top of this hill. And the corn wouldn't grow. He could never get corn to grow there. On the sides of the hill, it grew okay. So anyway, he started digging. And it didn't take long until he hit the top of the pyramid. And he hits this pyramid. He starts digging around. They go, oh my goodness. So anyway, they call the authorities. They come in and immediately recognized that this is a pyramid. Well, in Mexico, the cultural, the historical, the archives of archaeology is very, very tightly guarded. So they immediately went in, and the woman who was the lead archaeologist there, that's how I got to stay there, because of, like I say, a friend who knew her, and we go out there and stay at this archaeological site watching as they're digging up this archaeological site, and things, artifacts that had been laying there since that pyramid site was abandoned, but a complete pyramid covered with dirt. And I have a rather cute story that goes along with this. At night, everybody slept in hammocks, and you'd put a mosquito. It was a dry area, so there was not a lot of mosquitoes, but still, there's bugs all over the desert out there, and so you sleep in a hammock with mosquito netting. And so there was a man there, a Mexican man, and he was always in the hammock, and he had this song he would sing. And he would go repeat it and repeat it, and he'd say, basically translated, he said, I would never see Papantla, I would never see all the different towns and cities around. He said, I'll never see these again. And he kept singing this. And finally, I asked somebody, I said, you know, what's the story with this guy? And they said, oh, he's dying. He's dying. And so that's his song, that he'll never see these places again. I said, okay, for a while. And, you know, I didn't think much of it. And then later, I asked this one woman there, a Mexican woman who was at the site. I said, you know, when is he expected to die? You know, he's dying. Is there a prognosis? And they said, well, they don't really know. And I said, well, how long has he been dying in this condition? She said, about 20 years. And I, oh my goodness, I thought, this guy, he has people waiting on him. They bring him food. They, you know. But anyway, he had been bitten by a spider when he was young. And so they said, well, you're going to die. So anyway, for 20 years, this guy had laid there in a hammock singing this song and just, you know, waiting to die. A very cute little story, but that's very a true story. Anyway, back to layering of the earth. Now, this object, that the tree, going back to the petrified tree, now the petrification is just beginning. So there's rocks, the wood is petrifying, just let's say a piece about the size of a golf ball is visible, and there's much other smaller pieces where it's beginning to petrify. And what happens is because of the slow movement of water, which has silicates and other minerals in it, salts literally, those then deposit in place of the wood cells. And so the cells are basically probably due to acid action and other action of in the water. The cells are literally replaced with silicates and other forms of minerals that are in the earth. Now, I've been to a site, I believe it was over in North Dakota or South Dakota, possibly. But it's a petrified forest laying there. And it's actually a tourist attraction, so you can pay to go in. But these are giant trees, and they're petrified. But what's interesting, it looks like they were sawed apart with a chainsaw. And they're laying there in pieces, like kind of like firewood almost, but purely petrified. And of course, this process took millions and millions of years. And now these are exposed. So this process took place underground, and now they're exposed. So that just once again shows you the changing earth, the layering of earth, etc. Salt mines, for example, occur deep in the earth. Well, those were ocean areas once upon a time in history. I talked last week about moraines. Moraines are areas of the earth that don't fit their surroundings. So they developed maybe deep under the ocean or high in the mountains, and they're in an area that doesn't fit where that geological type is. So anyway, the earth is a very, very complex place. But you can't understand the earth. You will not understand the earth if you don't understand that the earth is continually layering with time. Material is coming in from outside. And like I said, this is where the salt in the oceans come from. And this is why, for example, the Great Lakes don't have any salt, because they're very recent. They're recent because the Laurentian ice cap covered that area for probably millions of years. And then when that quickly melted, when the pole shift occurred, when Venus came by, only a number of thousands of years ago, the Laurentian ice cap melted. That extended way over into Oregon in the west, down into Nebraska in the south, off to eastern Canada in the east, up towards Maine, and then around up into northern Canada. And at the time, Siberia of Russia was a temperate climate. That's where the vast herds of mastodons roamed. So this pole shift, it's very clear to see where the pole used to be. And when the pole shift occurred, and by the way, if you want to learn the physics of a pole shift, look at my pamphlet, Surviving Planet X passage. I have a complete description in there, complete with diagrams of that process. Okay, so anyway, the back to the idea of layering. The earth has been layered and layered and layered. So when you find oil that's 18 miles deep, that's because that came in. Oil is one of the common properties in comet tails, hydrocarbons. And the entire spectrum of hydrocarbons from the small chains up to the very long ones, which we call tar. So the benzenes and the small hydrocarbon chains. And then the nitrogen-hydrogen compounds, too. Hydrogen is very common. Sulfur-hydrogen compounds, very common. Other compounds that attach very readily with hydrogen, because remember, hydrogen is the most common element in the Earth, but it's not hydrogen gas. It's in chemical form, in chemicals, in chemical combination with other elements. Oxygen is another element that's very common in Earth. And it's not in the form of water. It's combined with other elements. Iron oxide, for example. Oxygen oxidates. In other words, it attaches very readily with almost everything. That's why oxygen destroys wood. I was talking about the fact that tree that we dug up was not destroyed. It was not decomposed because it got covered very quickly and there was no oxygen that could get to it. So anyway, that's an indication that some kind of major catastrophe occurred at that time. In all of these major catastrophes, the Earth didn't just jump up and do this by itself one day. The Earth had a major catastrophe from a passing large comet. And by the way, I'm getting away from using the term Planet X. Unfortunately, a term I developed back in my early research days, the electric universe, has been totally destroyed by a bunch of idiots running around the internet who are CIA supported, running around saying electric universe. And when any real science like my work comes out, and I've talked about this before, the takeover of science by the CIA in 1991. I've done a number of radio shows as guests recently on the John Wells show this past week, on Tim Kaiser's show, Revising Reality, and then also with Keith Roberts. He has a show on Revolution Radio. I did an entire show about that, about the CIA taking over the science world in 1991, and that's a complex story. I have a whole CD on that, the DVD dealing with the 20th anniversary of Hale-Bopp, the Harrington Expedition, and Planet X. But anyway, those terms, electric universe, which I created as a term in 1979 in my publications and in my lectures, etc., has been completely destroyed by a bunch of idiots. And, of course, these are promoted by the CIA. They don't want any real science out there. So what they do, little story here, they tried to badmouth me. They tried to destroy me by the typical technique of, he's an idiot, he's one of those tin hat guys, you know, a survivalist or whatever they tried to call me. But it didn't work because all they did was drive traffic to my page, and 99% of everybody that landed on my page from those that didn't know about me, they came to these other pages for other information. All of a sudden, they learn the name Jim McCanney, so they go to my page to see what I'm all about, and they go, holy cow, this guy makes sense. So they became fans of mine. They were driving traffic to my page. Wikipedia had all this negative, just complete lies about me, but it was driving traffic to my page. So they realized that, so they did away with that. So what do? They create a side groups that take these topics and make them into crazy topics, and then they can point to those and say, look at all those electric universe idiots. They don't have any theory. They don't make any sense. And so they destroy a topic, a terminology, and that's what the CIA does because they want you stupid. And look at what they do. You look at the web page or the internet, you just type in comets, and you come up with complete fabricated lies, something that could not possibly be true, but 95% of the people get their information. They don't get any, go any farther. And, of course, you're never going to see my name anyplace out there. But the original idea of talking about this just now is because of the fact that the real history of Earth is being kept from you. The real history of Earth is that it has been changed many, many times by comets. And my commentary just now was that the term Planet X has been totally destroyed by misinformation programs. So it's no longer a good term. So anyway, the best term that I can talk about are plasma discharge comets, because that's literally what they are. And they're big ones. They're not just little teeny ones. They're big ones. And they have come by Earth on many, many occasions. I've studied the mountain ranges of the Earth, and one of the really more obvious places is the southern Colorado Rocky Mountains, down in southern Colorado, where you have volcanic activity. You have probably 20 different episodes of mountain building, and it's all very obvious there because that's where it drops down to the elevated plateau, the Colorado Plateau, which is about a 5,000-foot elevation, goes all the way down through New Mexico and Arizona and Idaho. It's a huge elevated plateau, and most of the Rocky Mountains sit on that. But at that southern region in southern Colorado Rocky Mountains, you can see the probably 20 epochs of mountain building formation, and they're coming in from all directions. So the waves, the tidal waves of land that occurred when the large comets were passing by, come from all directions, and it's very visible there. So at any rate, the point is that Earth has been altered drastically many, many, many times, countless times. Countless is a big number. But there's probably been at least 20 major mass extinctions on Earth due to large plasma discharge comets and passing by, etc. And, you know, the layering of Earth, the hydrocarbons. So the influx, for example, if we would have been in the tail of Halebop, we would have had a tremendous influx of water and hydrocarbons and nitrogen-hydrogen compounds, which includes ammonia, various other forms of nitrogen-hydrogen compounds. We would have been inundated with this, in that the long chain hydrocarbons literally are what we call oil and tar. And when back in the 1200s, the first recorded use of oil is over in the Mideast, where they found lakes of oil, just there. They started picking it up and finding uses for it. They found out that it was burned. They could refine it a little bit, make oil for their lamps. And, of course, it's cold over there. The Mideast at night on the desert is very cold. So they made oil lamps. They started using it for warfare. They learned how to refine kerosene that was used. They would give containers as gifts to royalty. That was a very precious commodity. And then, of course, when they ran out of what was on the surface, they dug down a little bit and there was more. And so they kept digging, and then they realized, hey, there, underneath there, there's oceans of this stuff. So that's where the use of oil came from. And, of course, in the early 1900s, instead of using Tesla's technology to drive vehicles, etc., they wanted oil because they could take oil as a natural resource and then charge the public for it. And there was initiated the whole oil industry. And so anyway, that's a whole other story. But these deposits of oil, abiotic oil is one of the other myths. As soon as it became obvious to the public that this myth of dinosaur bones and fern forest causing oil, which they still call it fossil fuel, it's a total misnomer. But as soon as they found out that the public would not buy that story anymore, then they come up with abiotic oil, which is supposedly just formed down there all by itself, which is absurd. It's absolutely absurd, because you couldn't get all of this hydrocarbon chemical material and the carbon materials to move together to form vast quantities of oil, because hydrocarbons are just that, carbon with hydrogen, nothing else. And so how did these things form? How did all of this movement of carbon and hydrogen, and how did they dissociate from the chemicals that they were attached to them to form oil? And it just, it doesn't happen. There's no movement down there. There's not enough movement to bring all of these together, dissociate the carbon and the hydrogen, and then form oil. It's absurd. It doesn't work. And so anyway, the only way that those oil deposits formed is because during the time when that area of the Earth was exposed, there were vast influxes of oil, which meant we were caught in a comet tail, and the hydrocarbons were forming in that comet tail, and that's where those oil deposits came from. And we have that same situation today on the surface of the Earth. The ancients talk about this. They talk of the influx of burning naphtha coming in from the sky, and the the hail of brimstone and fire is, the burning naphtha that the ancients talk about, is because during the Venus event, which is where they're really discussing this, like in the Old Testament, the naphtha was the oil, the hydrocarbons, and when it hit the oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere and the meteorites are coming through blazing, of course it's going to ignite. And that's where the term fire and brimstone came from. So literally we have historical record of this. We see it on the ground. We see it deposited deep in the Earth's crust, in the mantle. We see vast quantities of oil. That's where it came from. So it's really important to understand that the Earth that we see, when you look out at the Earth, and scientists go around and pick up rocks and they go, oh, well, let's date this rock, or they do this on the moon, or they may do it on other planets, or they look at the surface of a comet. It has nothing to do with the original object itself. This is all accumulated from outer space. And it's as simple as that. So, you know, this fabrication of fairy tale science being pawned off on the public, literally, and I was been guests a number of shows recently, and it seems like every time I'm a guest on a show and that they have callers, the people call in and ask questions. Inevitably, almost now, it happened on Joyce Riley's show the other day, Wednesday. It happened on a couple other shows. People call in and they say, I think with John Moore's show the other day, people call in and they say, Jim McCanney really has the only science today that makes any sense. Or they make comments like this. You know, I won't go into the comments that were made because I like to hear comments like that, and that's gratifying. But as a scientist, I'm objective, and when I look at my work objectively, it is the only real science available today. It's just nobody else has even a clue. Even the people that try and copy me do a terrible job of copying me, and they throw in all kinds of other bizarre things. And standard science is just off in la-la land. it's absolutely absurd. So the reason these shows are important is because you start to understand really what's going on this planet Earth where we live. Now, I want to divert a little bit here to some listener mail, and this is what I love. When I get on a topic like salt, etc., people start sending in emails of different places that they're aware of. I have been personally in salt mines, and it's a very strange feeling because it's just solid salt, and it's kind of humid, but pure salt, the walls, everything, and it's kind of interesting because people will make... They've even made churches in salt mines. They've made little grottos or little furniture where you can sit, etc., in various salt mines. But it's a kind of a strange feeling to be in the middle of a salt mine. And what the salt mine is from is literally the salt has crystallized out of an ocean, and it builds up down on the bottom as more and more salt comes in from the top. And that's another indication that more and more salt is coming in, because if you had a certain salt content in a body of water, then there's no reason for it to start to solidify at the bottom of the lake or ocean or whatever. But if you have more and more salt coming in, then the water is saturated. In other words, you cannot get any more water, or you cannot get any more salt into the solution in that water. So it starts crystallizing and dropping out, almost like snow in a sense. But therefore, you get a layering of the salt at the bottom of the ocean, and then someday when the ocean goes away for whatever reason, it evaporates or it's elevated due to, like, one guy sent in an email here from Redmond, Utah, and here's a salt mine 5,000-foot elevation, and it's a family-owned operation, and they have another element that's on top of there is called bentonite. It's bentonite clay, and it's used for many health purposes. Also a natural occurrence from the ocean and other geological processes that occurred in that area, but a super fine, super pure form of clay. But the salt in that location, they claim, has 60 essential elements that are good for health. Himalayan salt has 84. So in the analysis of these, the salt content, the elements in the salt. But as I said, the way these massive deposits occur is because more and more salt is coming in from above. Well, where does that salt come from? Outer space. How do these elements combine? They combine in the comet tail, just like hydrogen and oxygen form water, just like the carbons and the hydrogens form oil, just like the nitrogen and the hydrogens form the compounds like ammonia. These are formed in comet tails, and you see these. You see these in comet tails. And standard science, of course, cannot explain them. Earth has a lot of sulfates in composition. In fact, the largest salt composition in planet Earth are sulfates. Sodium is second, and calcium is down in the list there a bit, but the sulfates, so where did those come from? Well, and then also, where did the iron come from? Venus, our next inner planet neighbor, does not have a lot of iron content. It doesn't have that dense iron core like Earth, but that's because Earth, first of all, the core seed chunk of material that formed Earth was a dense piece of iron and other, I'm sure, very heavy nucleotides, etc., that came from the inner core of a star that blew up. And so that's where Earth's core came from, very different than Venus. Venus spent a lot of time forming in the solar system, and so has a lot of sulfur, oxygen, the sulfur dioxide, the sulfuric acid in the atmosphere of Venus, the carbon-oxygen compounds in the atmosphere of Venus. So Venus spent a lot of time in various parts of the solar system, but not that close to the sun. It spent most of its formative years as a comet outside of the orbit of the current orbit of Venus, what we now call the orbit of Venus. So I've also talked about the fact that Mercury has a sodium tail, just like our moon. But Earth spent a good deal of time, first of all, it had the very rich iron core as the initial seed of the comet, and then Earth spent a lot of its time in its formative years inside, very close to the sun. So its orbit swung in around the sun and then farther out, so that's where all the silicates came from, the sulfates in the calcium, etc., and the sodium. And so the sodium is still building up. But after Earth formed, standard science in their model that Earth just formed from a collapsing ball of gas, if it did that, which it didn't, it would be super hot. There wouldn't be any hydrogen compounds. that would all be baked out of the earth. You wouldn't have hydrogen, you wouldn't have oxygen, you wouldn't have all of these elements that are related. You probably wouldn't have much nitrogen, and you probably wouldn't have any life, because oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and carbon are the basis of life, and these would have all gone away in the extremely hot stage of Earth's formation, if it formed that way, which, like I say, it did not. The way the plasma discharge comet model, when a planet is forming by that model, you are accumulating all of these elements, and you start with the water in the atmosphere. It may be hydrogen and oxygen in other chemical combinations with other gases, but you have it there, and then you also have the atmosphere there. Like Venus. Venus is a young planet. It already has a massive atmosphere. Much of it, it will lose over a period of time. There's another physics problem. You can do this, very simple. Start with a planet with a certain size of atmosphere and a certain temperature of that atmosphere. Remember that Venus, the temperature of the atmosphere of Venus is hot enough to melt lead. So the Venus is literally losing atmosphere at a tremendous rate right now because it is because of the high heat of the atmosphere. And so you, if it formed 4.5 billion years ago, Venus would be almost the size of Jupiter when it formed, which doesn't make any sense at all. And so, and it's still extremely hot. Venus is simply a brand new planet with a hot atmosphere. But the point is, the planets begin with an atmosphere. They begin with the composition that will form the oceans at a certain point, and they continue to draw in this material. And so after, in a state like Earth, Earth is in now the biological state, what I called in my plasma discharge comet model. If you read my work, I have the nuclear stage. That's when it's super hot. That's when the comet is forming. That's when the electron beam is extremely hot. That's when you have nucleosynthesis going on in the comet formation. You know, those X-rays are not just from nothing. Those are the X-rays and the gamma rays that you actually detect in comets, especially in big comets. That's part of a formative process of nucleosynthesis. So it's actually forming heavy nucleotides in and building them up so that they're in the Earth, and that's what creates a lot of the heat of Earth. Today in Earth, as we're a very aging planet, a lot of the internal heat from Earth is from nucleotides that are decaying. Well, those were formed in that formative process when that electron beam in the plasma discharge comet model was creating a large quantity of heavy nucleotides. Earth spent a lot of its time very close to the sun where the iron is. There's a high concentration of iron in orbit around the sun. We can see that. We actually do see that in the zodiacal light, primarily iron that's in like a Saturn-type ring around the sun. So you can tell a lot about the formation of a planet and where it spent its time by looking at its composition. We also know about Venus from the ancients, that it was a rogue comet. The nucleus came in, was captured by Jupiter, and not spit out like Velikovsky. That was one of Velikovsky's mistakes, is that he said Venus came out of Jupiter. He thought it was spit out of Jupiter, which is not correct. It was captured. And there again, if the work of TJJC and Newton back in the early 1900s would have the work regarding capture, then their work wasn't exonerated because there was no resisting medium. I had talked about this in previous shows. It wasn't until my work came along in the 1970s that showed that, no, there was no resisting medium, but it was the tail drag of the comets that caused the circularization of orbit. And so it did the same thing as a resisting medium, but it was the electric action of the comet, the plasma discharge comet model, showing that the charged nucleus, negatively charged, is drawing in these ions, and they're forming in the tail and building up, eventually becoming a planet, but also circularizing the orbit. So once a planet is formed, it's like Earth. We have the oceans, the hydrogen and the oxygen have formed. There's a continual influx of water coming in on a daily basis. Then the salts are coming in. Those 84 elements in the Himalayan salt came in from outer space on a constant basis. Sodium being one of the primary elements in salt, but it's not the only one. And so when companies like Morton Salt remove all those elements from seawater, they're selling all of that on the market as another form of profit. They could give you the salt because that's what's left over in the extraction process of seawater, or if they get it from underground caves. They're extracting all of those elements, you know, the magnesium and the, you know, the copper and the everything else that's in that salt. They're extracting it, not the least of which is gold. They're extracting that from the salt, selling it, and then what you're left with is this cleansed sodium chloride, which is literally terrible for you. That's why doctors tell you don't eat salt. They're really not telling you not to eat salt. They're telling you not to eat what we commonly call table salt, because it's just sodium chloride. It's what's left after the Morton Company gets done taking all the good stuff out and selling that on the market. And so the Himalayan salt, the other reason it's good, or the salt from these caves, is because it's in a pristine state. It was covered over very rapidly because of why? Catastrophic event from comets from outside. And so instead of that term Planet X, which has been totally destroyed, I'm going to start talking about what they really are, plasma discharge comets, the McCanny comets. So if they want to talk about that, yeah, say McCanny comet. That's what these are, not Planet X, McCanny comet. Okay, say that, and I'll get a lot of great advertising. Thank you very much. But anyway, that's literally what's going on. Planet X is really a bad term, and it's been totally destroyed for 20 reasons. It's a bad term. So anyway, that's basically the layering of Earth. Very, very important topic. Why do we have salt mines down there? Why do we have oil deposits down there? I want to spend a little bit of time here talking about the hurricane season. This past year, the Hurricane Prediction Center, which is part of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, funded out of our wonderful Washington, D.C. Pretend government, they made a prediction, and it was very bizarre. They said it would be a slightly above hurricane season, and they have, of course, egg all over their face once again. It was comical because they made their prediction in April. The hurricane season starts in June, June 1st, runs till into November. And but anyway, the two hurricanes of the season so far, one happened in January, Alex, and the other one happened in early May, Bonnie. So since those hurricanes had already happened, they had to up their hurricane prediction by one as the season started in May. So that's very comical. So they upped their prediction by one, and since we have not had any hurricanes at all, and we're midway through the season. Why is that? Because we haven't had any planetary conditions that would spawn hurricanes. And why is that? Because it's the electrical conditions of planet Earth that drive hurricanes, not warm water. So the 20 conditions that they list in their computer model to predict hurricanes are all bogus. And what they really do is they go back in time and they look at past years, and they think because there's La Nina is waning that there will be more hurricanes this year than in 2012. It's total bogus science, but they get paid to do this. So anyway, when I made my prediction for this year, I noted that the mid-January would be a prime time for hurricanes, and that's exactly when Alex occurred, Hurricane Alex, and it occurred in the North Atlantic. by the Canary Islands, nowhere near warm water. Where do you find warm water in the North Atlantic in January? You know, excuse me, boys and girls, can these people really go home and face their families at night and sleep at night? And like, you know, hey, Dad, hey, Mom, if you work at the Hurricane Prediction Center, you know, do you really make a living doing this? But anyway, then Bonnie came in early May, and once again, that was an electrical alignment between Mercury. The Alex one was Mercury, new moon, the Earth's new moon passing, and Earth, a very minor combination of planetary alignments, but also combined with some solar activity. The Bonnie, the hurricane in May, was due to the fact that Mercury, the new moon passing, and Mars were in a perfect electrical alignment, and that is what caused the Hurricane Bonnie to form. These electrical alignments, and what that does is causes a very large increase in the current sheets passing Earth, and that works down into our troposphere and, of course, affects the weather, including hurricanes. What's going to happen the rest of the hurricane season unless they have some manipulated storms? Nothing. There are no electrical conditions in the solar system that are scheduled or that are on the horizon looking at the conditions in the solar system. So that's kind of a little bit of a wrap-up of the current hurricane season. So once again, the National Hurricane Prediction Center, egg all over their face. Remember, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and scroll down to the center column picture of the day. I have some other information there on salt and the show topic for tonight. Also remember that this week's extra paid cast, $3.95 per month, $3.95 per month. You can join and subscribe on the webpage. Every week I have a paid cast. This week's topic is Tesla's Mind Part 1, and it's the first in a long series of this topic of Tesla's mind, understanding what was Tesla thinking. And so there's a lot of material on the internet, most of it incorrect, dealing with Tesla. But the trick is, what really was he thinking? And so you're going to learn some electromagnetic theory. You're going to learn what was available to Tesla. How did he come up with his ideas? What was his vision of the world, of the planet Earth, and of the universe, etc.? What were some misconceptions that he had? What were the limitations to his understanding, etc.? So Understanding Tesla's Mind, Part 1, that's this week on the paid cast. And once again, you can go to the webpage, sign up for the subscription, or if you buy more than $100 worth of products on the webpage, on the secure web ordering page, you get the first month free. If you buy over $300, you get 6 months free of the paid cast. Once again, the website, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.